The Honorable, the Judges of the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit.
We are ready to hear argument on our next case, 1924-52, Shepherd versus the Visitors of Virginia State University. Mr. Crowley, we'll hear from you.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Scott Crowley and I represent the appellant, the plaintiff below, Malcolm Shepherd. This appeal concerns two issues of law. The first is whether Shepherd stated the claim for sex discrimination in an educational program under Title IX of the Education Amendments of 1972, when he was adjudicated for assault against a former girlfriend at Virginia State University in Petersburg, Virginia. While the university took no action against the former girlfriend, who I've identified in my brief as Student A, for larceny arising out of the same incident. The second issue is whether Mr. Shepherd raised a property interest in Virginia State University's student code of conduct governing disciplinary actions as a predicate for his claim of violation of his due process rights under the 14th Amendment when the administrator of the disciplinary program named Henry DeBose suspended Mr. Shepherd haphazardly without an opportunity to be heard. Focusing first on my Title IX claim, he proceeds under the selective enforcement theory first articulated by the Second Circuit in the case of Youssef versus Vassar College. Mr. Shepherd claims that since the charges against him arose from the same general altercation, which is a theft of personal property, which led to a confrontation and then shoving, the circumstances surrounding Mr. Shepherd and Student A were sufficiently similar that the fact that Virginia State University took disciplinary action only against Mr. Shepherd and not against Student A or Student B stated.
Mr. Crowley, if I could interrupt right there.
Please.
Whether they were or not similar is really not my question right now, but you know, we've not specifically held that for a Title IX case you have to have a comparator. But it sounds like your position acknowledges that that's a requirement and you think it's been sufficiently pled. Am I understanding your position correctly?
I don't want to sound vague, but I think I have enough to plead a comparator case. But I will say that there are other circuits, including four circuits, that have ruled on this precise issue since we briefed this issue. And I have the citations where they've said enough of the theories under USF. All we need to do, we need to go back to original principles and look at the text of Title IX, which says, is there discrimination based on sex in an educational program? And you just need, and then you need to look at the analogous Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. That statute, of course, requires that discrimination be only a motivating factor. And so whether we look at it as a strict comparator analysis or whether we look at it more broadly into whether there's enough facts in here to infer at this stage of the pleadings, infer a cause of action.
Mr. Crowley, did you say that there are several cases that you believe are in your favor that have come out since you filed your brief?
Right.
Okay, so have you submitted a 28J letter to give the court an opportunity to look at those as well as to give opposing counsel an opportunity to look at those?
No, and I'll just be honest. I've come across these cases last night in preparing for this argument.
Okay.
I'd be happy to supplement, and I understand it's not unusual, but some of these cases have come out just, you know, in fall of 2020, after we briefed it. And I've got cases from the 3rd, the 7th, the 8th, and the 9th circuits that have all followed the 7th circuit in Doe versus Purdue University, which says, you know, we don't need to be bound by these strict theories of life.
Well, let me ask you a different question. How can you say that Student A was treated favorably when she was found responsible for the theft?
She was treated favorably in the enforcement in that she was only adjudicated for the theft after Mr. Shepherd approached the Department of Education Office of Civil Rights and filed a complaint against Virginia State University, because until that time.
So no, you're speculating that nothing was going to happen to student A, otherwise we would have to speculate that, wouldn't we?
I wouldn't use the word speculate. I would use the term that I've alleged enough facts to infer a cause of action that gets me over the edge for a 12B6 motion under Iqbal and Twombly. Now, whether those facts can be borne out in discovery, I don't know because I've had no discovery, but I think I'm entitled to an inference that when Mr. Shepherd is receives a notice of pre-hearing disciplinary action the day after the altercation on October 25th of 2016, and then with less than a week he's adjudicated, and it's not until 4 months later that the university sends any sort of notice to student A, and only after the Office of Civil Rights from the Education Department contacts VSU and says there's been this complaint, and then 4 days later they hurry up and file papers to get student A. I think that is beyond speculation. Now, those facts may not bear out discovery, but I think I'm entitled to
inference. You're saying that's a reasonable inference based on the timeline of events.
That's a better way of saying what I'm trying to say. Yes.
But the university had proceeded against student B much earlier than that. Isn't that correct?
Let me get my timeline. The university sent a pre-hearing notice to student B on January 11th, which was 3 months after my client was adjudicated and already left the university. But that was before the Office of Civil Rights got involved. So you're right, that the student B was subjected to discipline, but not till sometime later.
To the threshold question, if I could. I understand that there are some other circuits that have looked at these types of Title IX claims under a more generic Twombly analysis. But in this case, as I understand it, you have pled and you have argued until today solely under a USEF proceeding based on selective enforcement. So what entitles you to come in at oral argument and seek to change the gravitas of your pleading?
Well, my argument has always been that if you look at the circumstances in total, I have alleged on behalf of Mr. Shepherd a prima facie case of sex discrimination. So, yes, I've chosen to call it selective enforcement under USEF. But the fact of the matter that all of these charges, the theft and the assault, arose from the same incident involving the same characters, the same decision makers, the same code of conduct. The fact that one was treated more leniently than the other gives me an inference of sex discrimination. Now, it could be
real. Tell us why you say he was treated more leniently, because as I understand the pleadings and the briefing, there isn't any contest as to your client being guilty of the charges against him, nor is there any question as to student A being guilty of the charges against her, nor of the penalty imposed against student A. That the only difference between the parties is the timing of when the discipline was imposed. Is there anything else that you say reflects a difference between the two?
Well, the timing, but I also assert, I'm going to take this timing one step further and assert that had Mr. Shepherd never complained to the Office of Civil Rights, the university would have never enforced any disciplinary action against student A. And you're right, I'm not saying that the outcome against Mr. Shepherd was wrong or unfair, but it's essentially like two basketball teams playing and the refs only calling fouls against one team. Now, those fouls may be legitimate fouls, but if they're only going to call them against one team, at some point you need to say, why is the university calling fouls at all? Maybe all of this should be left up to the court authorities and not impose sanctions of suspension. And that's really where I'm going in this case.
But that, how did they not call a foul against I think it's student A, when she was found responsible for the theft?
But they were only shamed into that because he complained.
I mean, it's
right.
Well, just to go with your analogy, you said that there were no fouls called against one team, when in fact there was. That student was found responsible. Now, it might have been for a football analogy, a late flag thrown, but the flag was thrown. So how does that fit into your argument?
It was thrown only after an appeal to a much higher authority that could have done some harm against.
So that goes back to your reasonable inference, our reasonable inference discussion from earlier.
Right.
Okay, go ahead.
With the court's permission, I think I may move on to the due process issue. Under Board of Regents versus Ross, the Supreme Court said that property interests, we know they're not created by the Constitution, but they can be created and their dimensions defined by existing rules or understandings that stem from an independent source. And as it goes on, such as state law, but it doesn't have to be state law. The fact that VSU, like many public institutions, publishes precise procedures to be invoked in the situation of student discipline shows that the student has a property interest in the enforcement, in the utilization of those procedures, so that the university can't simply jettison those and say, we're going to suspend the student without a hearing, without even hearing what the student has to say. And that's what happened.
So,
counsel, am I correct that the district court addressed this issue in the alternative and found on the merits that there was no property interest, but also that qualified immunity applied?
Yes. And I obviously disagree with both points, because there has to be some veneer of property interest for due process when the university gives these rights. They accept tuition from the student. It's a public university. They have to, it doesn't mean they have to provide all the niceties of due process that is found in the court of law, but they have to at least hear the student out. And that didn't happen here.
Even if we assume that the district court was wrong on the merits, if qualified immunity applies, that would still defeat your client's claim.
It would.
And as I read your brief on page 16, you say it's an open question whether students enjoy a property interest in higher education that affords due process protection. And it would seem to me with that you in effect have conceded there is no clearly established law which would require the application of qualified immunity.
I think what I would revise my statement to say there may not have been a state law that guarantees a student a right to continuing education, but there are these procedures in place that guarantee the students due process before they're disciplined.
And well, if you, Mr. Crowley, or can you, I mean, if there's no Supreme Court authority saying what you just said, that these policies create a property interest, and there's no Fourth Circuit law saying that. Just on that basis, well, I understand your argument, but given the fact that we don't have anything, you know, at any appellate court, is there any way it can be clearly established?
My time's running out. Can I just answer that question?
Yes, go right ahead.
Thank you. There are so many cases out there of this sort that where courts acknowledge some minimal, some veneer of due process has to be given before a student can be either expelled or suspended. Just Board of Regents versus Roth alone, that comes from 1972. The idea that an administrator who administers these policies with these guarantees in the student code of conduct would somehow think that he could kick a student out without even asking the student what happened or explain why he's doing it. I mean, anyone would understand that at this point. It's almost like a police officer questioning a suspect without giving Miranda rights. I mean, it's just known. Now, 6 decades ago, it wasn't known, but it's been known since the 70s, and it's the same year. I mean, it's BSU that provided these policies. All we're doing is saying, if your policies say you can't suspend a student without telling him or her why you're doing it and giving that person an opportunity to be heard, then that's a violation of due process.
All right. Thank you very much. Mr. Crowley, you have some time left on rebuttal.
Thank you.
And we'll now hear from Ms. Kayla.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Michelle Callen for appellees. The district court properly dismissed Mr. Shepherd's complaint against each of the two defendants. As to VSU, Mr. Shepherd's Title IX claim fails because he acknowledges that USIF's selective enforcement framework applies, but Mr. Shepherd fails to point to any remotely similar comparator of a different gender. Now, I'd like to add another relevant date in terms of the timeline of what occurred in this case. Your Honors, less than a month after the event at issue here, on December 17th, 2019, the Office of Judicial Affairs at VSU gave notice to both students A and student B to let them know to email OJA. Yes, Your Honor. I think I heard a false judicial question.
Yeah, there's a false flag there.
So I think it's worth noting, Your Honors, that December 17th is also a relevant date here, and that plainly comes well before any complaint to federal authorities. I think any theory that this case is premised and that the disciplinary proceedings somehow followed from Mr. Shepherd's complaint to the Department of Education is highly speculative and is undercut by the timeline in this case, too. As my friend on the other side of
the And what was it that you said happened? What was the date you wanted to add? Sorry, I missed it.
December 17th. December 17th, 2016, which is less than a month after the incident here where Mr. Shepherd pushed student A. So that just goes
that's,
to show
that date is what you've just recited to us. That's in the record that we have.
Yes, Your Honor.
Let me ask you, as I understand Mr. Crowley's argument, he says that notwithstanding pleading and arguing under USIF with a selective enforcement theory, that we really ought to look at the Title IX case more under a Twombly analysis instead of a USIF analysis. What's your response to that?
I think twofold, Your Honor. So he himself only briefs the selective enforcement theory. And I think it's worth noting an event that this court issued an unpublished decision this past October, where this court recognized the USIF standard as well. That's the Doe 2 by and through Doe 1 v. Fairfax County. It's 2020 Westlaw 6158091. It's an unpublished decision, but it is one in which the USIF standard was referenced by this court. But even applying the plain Iqbal Twombly pleading standard, the complaint here plainly fails that as well. I mean, the complaint does little more than saying, because they are female and because I am male, I was treated differently. That's just insufficient, even under Iqbal Twombly, to state a Title IX claim. And I think that's highlighted, that the insufficiency of this complaint is highlighted by one of the cases that my friend on the other side relies on. So in his brief, he relies on the Doe v. Amherst College case out of the District of Massachusetts. And there were allegations that the college at issue encouraged the female student to file a complaint against the male student when there were sexual misconduct allegations. And by contrast, the university, when the shoe was on the other foot and it was the male who was alleging sexual misconduct against the female, the plaintiff there alleged that the university did not encourage the male victim to file a complaint. And so the differential treatment by the university of the male versus the female students there was the allegations in the complaint that there was a difference in treatment. Here, the only difference is a pace in the proceedings of the disciplinary process. Student A was disciplined and faced consequences to larceny in the disciplinary process. So the only difference is simply the pace, and that's insufficient to show differential treatment, but it's certainly insufficient to show that the reason for the differential treatment was based off sex, especially when Mr. Shepherd committed a violent offense under the student code and student A committed a property offense. He simply took a cell phone charger and some clothing items. So that plainly explains the difference in the pace of the disciplinary proceedings. I think it bears noting, unless the court has additional questions on the Title IX piece of the case, we think that this case plainly fails under both a selective enforcement theory and a plain Iqbal Twombly pleading standard. Moving on to Mr. DeBose, those claims fail on the merits, but at the very least, Mr. DeBose is entitled to qualified immunity. On the due process claim, Mr. Shepherd himself admits that this court has not adopted his theory of a property interest. And on his equal protection claim, Mr. Shepherd fails to cite any case, let alone one from this court, the Supreme Court of the United States, or the Supreme Court of Virginia, adopting his novel same incident theory. This court on multiple occasions has emphasized the deference that it accords to academic decision-making, particularly in the disciplinary process. That deference is appropriate here, and the district court's decision should be affirmed. Unless the court has any more questions, I'll yield the remainder of my time.
Seeing no hands up, I'll thank you, Ms. Callen, for your argument, and we'll go back to Mr. Crowley. He's got rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just want to, Ms. Callen said something to the effect of that our side was alleging just because Mr. Shepherd is male and student A is female, there must be discrimination. And I mean, that's simply not the case. We're looking at the totality of the circumstances, the fact that it occurred at roughly the same time, same incident, actually, in that the university was so prompt in getting notice of pre-hearing to Mr. Shepherd and then did nothing against student A or student B for some time, sent out a notice of pre-hearing against student B on December 17th, about 6 or 7 weeks after the incident, which is ironic because student B was not nearly as culpable as student
that, A. That notice went to both students, didn't it? Students A and B.
No, our facts are it only went out to A. I mean, excuse me, B.
What's your JA site for that? If I can find it, if you don't have it, quickly. Mr. Crowley, that's all right. I can find it in the record.
Okay. I think in my paragraph, I need to correct what I said. Paragraph 37 of the amended complaint says it sent on December 17th, it sent her an email, not a pre-hearing notice, but an email saying, please contact our office. That email was ignored. And then on March 20th, of 2017.
Okay. So you're saying that the basis for you saying that the December 17th email only went to student B is what's alleged in your complaint?
Correct. We alleged in the complaint that an email was
right
to student A saying contact the office, not what it should have said, which is this is a pre-hearing notice.
Okay. So you agree it did go to student A on December 17th?
An email went out saying, please contact.
Right. Saying, yeah, please contact the office about your, about the conduct or whatever.
Yeah. That's
okay.
Accurate. And I apologize for my misunderstanding.
Okay. Thanks.
But student A ignored that notice and the university took no action to follow up or impose any discipline until after Mr. Shepherd went to the Office of Civil Rights. He actually went January 23rd, but the university didn't get notice of that complaint until March 16th of 2017. And then on March 20th, they issued the pre-hearing notice against student A. And then April 7th, I believe, of 17 is when they had the hearing, the adjudicatory hearing for student A, and found you responsible for theft. Unless there are any questions, that's my presentation.
All right, thank you very much. We appreciate the argument of both counsel, which you will be taking under advisement.